A really big thank you to you all for making it this time in the afternoon and after our recent incident with fire alarms or whatever it was. Anybody know where the quote's from? Or who wrote it? It's Douglas Adams. He likes to consider himself the original DNA at Cambridge because he predated the discovery of DNA. Hopefully this kind of just sets your mind in the right mood for the content of my presentation this afternoon. Those of you who don't know who I am, what we've done, etc. I consult on Linux and open source in New Zealand. I do an awful lot of work through IBM New Zealand. But along the way, we developed a consumer-focused appliance for the local market called MyPVR, based on Myth TV. And this kind of captures some of the trials and tribulations of trying to produce a consumer-focused product. And it's not a to-do list so much as possibly a what-not-to-do list. So we're going to talk about the consumer, that special breed of customer. And it really is a world away from the enterprise. Are any of you here developers or architects or sysadmins in the enterprise space? Have any of you actually tried to produce a consumer-focused product? So we're going to cover what the expectations are around your product and just how different yours may be when compared with that of a consumer. And trying to align those expectations with the underlying technology. As we said, it's the consumer view of technology, so technology will be the focus. How important is the look and feel in the consumer market? And does cool eye candy really work? Well, it's a bit of an easy answer, but we'll cover it anyway. And then the joy of trying to support customers or supporting consumers, just how different are they? So what are the expectations of your target market when you're just trying to take a product out there? And anyone with an enterprise background, hopefully you've got a good team of BAs and project managers and people around you who can actually produce a well-focused set of requirements. Can you do that in the consumer market? And their expectations around your product and maybe a little bit too high. They may come to you with preconceived views of the technology, preconceived ideas about your product. So let's start with probably one of the most simple consumer products there is, the fridge. It's really clear. When you go to buy a fridge, you know what to expect. At least I hope you do. I'd be deeply worried if you didn't. So can you try and align what a consumer expects from your product with what it's really capable of, or are you going to get tripped up? And true consumers will often perform limited market research or technical research, and a lot of that's actually just focused on what's the price of the product, not what is it really capable of. It's the early adopters and the geeks who actually really investigate, really look at the capabilities, really look at what it can do. And you'll be truly amazed.
With all due respect, John, I am head of IT, and I have it on good authority. If you type Google into Google, you can break the internet. So please, go and try it. Even for a joke.
Even technically competent consumers can make some very interesting assumptions and believe the most hideous tales. So this causes a problem. How are they interpreting the information you're providing or that's available out there already? Our products focused in the digital TV market, it's a PVR. Freeview New Zealand got tripped up quite badly by marketing their digital TV solution as high resolution because that was interpreted immediately as high definition and they were taken to court over it. We made quite clear early on that our PVR was based on typical PC-style technology. One of the regular questions was, can we just use that then as our home computer? Well, it's an appliance. It's supposed to be a black box. You're not supposed to be trying to run Office and Word and Firefox and so on it. And one of the most popular requests is to do their entire web browsing and email on the PVR. And because we were reasonably new piece of technology. Well, where's your support for Blu-ray and HD DVD? Well, we can't do that at the moment in the Linux space legally. It's bad enough trying to do DVD in the Linux space legally. And then we got tripped up just by our look and feel. We went for a kind of sexy, high-end, home theater style cases, and people assumed we had amplifier capabilities. Yeah, it was our own fault. The look was too close, especially one particular model which actually had something that looked like a big volume control on the front. Therefore, well, that controls the volume. No, it's actually a big on-off button. And so they come up to us. We did a big trade show and come up and go, oh, this looks really great, sort of thing. I want, how many speakers can I plug into the back? You know, what's the power of the amplifier? Because they're used to those AV, DVD surround sound systems that you can get now where everything's built in. And the big thing, especially in the big consumer shows, was about multi-zone and multi-room capability. We provided five different types of TV out, well, video out. Can you run five different rooms off the same unit, running five different video outs, controlling five different screens and five different remotes? No. And all of a sudden, when we start to look at, well, what are the real requirements these consumers want, we're heading right into the Dilbert zone, and it's horrible. And I thought the Dilbert zone was in the enterprise. No, it's there wherever you go. So when we started capturing information at this trade show, it occurred very, very early on. We really had to think twice, three times, four times, go and hide in the corner and cry for a while before you say yes to anything, because you're heading into a world of pain. And qualify your response because, oh, well, maybe we can consider it. But as soon as you say yes, they go, great, I'll buy a unit. And then you're going to have to look after them. And what you've said yes to might not be that simple to implement. It's a really neat idea. It's going to make the product so much easier to use. It's going to take you 18 months to develop that real simple extra feature. So in the end, what we decided was just to be really clear about both the capabilities and the constraints around the product. Because we'd rather someone go away and buy someone else's solution and not have the world of pain associated with that one extra sale. And then think about where your product lives in the market. Because that can affect things like how they look at the lifespan of the product. Now, these numbers are a little bit abstract. An awful lot of people we talk to, actually, these are actually too low. Now, when you buy a fridge, a washing machine, you expect a reasonable 10-plus year lifetime, although that's starting to diminish with modern consumer goods. Your typical home theater equipment, a CRT TV or a VCR, 5 to 10 years. PCs, iPods, etc. It starts to diminish as the technology gets more complex or gets more throwaway. We got an inquiry from a customer who had a VCR that they've been using for about 12 years. He'd really like a PVR that would last longer than his VCR. No, I couldn't guarantee that. Sorry. And then also, at what point in this cycle do you get your value for money? When do you feel you got your value for money from a kettle or a fridge? You know, a kettle's dirt cheap, but you might not feel like it's paid for itself until you've had it a couple of years. A fridge is a much more expensive item, but you're going to expect to get 10 years out of it. And the expected lifespan, though, also doesn't actually relate to the price of the product. You know, and early adopters who get funky technology expect to pay a high price for that. It's well understood. If you can get into that niche, then you can charge that higher price. You can get that better margin on your product. So are you in a niche, or are you aiming for mass market? And has your technology that you're using in your product actually reached that mass market appeal? And if it hasn't, can you survive long enough for the market to tip to the point where you're selling into that mass market? And is the market big enough for you to survive? And at the end of the day, perhaps you're not actually targeting consumers. Most of the people really interested in our product early on weren't traditional consumers because the market hadn't tipped. And when you look at the design of a product, there's the well-known design classics, the days where design was quite simple. A car came in black and a fridge came in white. Things were quite obvious. It's not that way anymore. If you want to stand out, as Apple and Dell, and even Asus with the EPC have shown us, you've got to make sure you've got some variety in your product line. And even fridges are doing it. So don't ever underestimate the power of the eye candy for your product. It's prevalent typically right now in the GUI space. We all love eye candy in our GUI. So do you want eye candy in your product? When we started demoing our product to high-end hi-fi shops and potential retailers, a lot of them went, cool, we can put it in the dark demo room because it's got really good blue lights. And consumers will buy it because it's got sexy blue lights. I'm not kidding. That was the first thing they took to. Blue lights in the fridge? Believe it or not, there's actually a health reason for having a blue light in your fridge. US researchers have discovered blue light dims the appetite. So if you go to a fridge and you open the door and the light's blue, you'll eat less from your fridge. If the light's red, you will eat more from your fridge. So there may be another value to your eye candy more than just the... Yeah, it's crazy. But then, oh, okay, we've got the product out there, they're starting to buy it, and now we've got to look after them. And whatever you do, your support's going to be three times as much as you expect it. Probably, if not more. We got a review in Tone, Hi-Fi, and AV magazine in New Zealand. And one of the big things they stated in the review was they thought our support was great. That's a big deal. But you've got to just pitch your support at the right level. You're really dealing sometimes with... Imagine trying to sell something like this to your grandmother or your parents or whoever. Like my mum took 12 years to learn how to use our first VCR and 3 years to learn how to use its replacement. You just got to find the right technical balance. And if you're going to provide phone support, make sure it's good. The very sad but very true bit is, usually when a customer gets in touch and they've got a particular problem, we do ask them, have you tried turning it off and on again? It will solve most of our problems. So what form do you want your support to take? It's really hard these days when you can go and buy a cheap ADSL router and get free 24/7, 365 phone support on an 0800 number. That's because they're selling by the millions, these devices, and they can afford to work at that scale. It's expensive. Are you geared up for it? Web-based support can really turn consumers off. Most of you in the room won't have a problem trying to find help and documentation online. Most of my customers wouldn't even think of going anywhere near the website. And community support. You bring up this product, you go, oh, no worries. We don't need to provide much in the way of additional support because the community will look after them. Sorry, I'm afraid that's for geeks, it's for technologists, it's for most of the people in this room. And email tends to be a bit too impersonal for a lot of them. One of the reasons we had problems initially shifting units is that we didn't actually have a shop. We didn't have someone they could go in and talk to about the product. They didn't want to talk to us over email. They typically said, can you please give me a ring? I'm thinking about buying your product. So what steps can you take to try and reduce your support overhead? Because that ends up being one of your biggest costs. Documentation. I probably spent more time doing documentation around the product than development. Big thing is they expect a printed manual. Even though they'll never read it, and just doing it online is not going to be sufficient. And make sure you do put some nice pretty pictures in. And don't intimidate them with your manual. I didn't actually bring it with me. I've got a manual at home for my first ever DVD player from Philips. It's 1.5 inches thick. I'm not kidding, it literally is 1.5 inches thick. Admittedly, it has the manual printed 9 times in 9 different languages in the same bound book. But it's intimidating. A lot of consumers would get home, look at the manual and go, There's no way I'm going to get through that and throw it to one side. What we did is we produced a simple four-page sheet, the back of which had this diagram with a quick guide on how to use the buttons on the remote control. Great. We got emails and phone calls off customers asking how to use the hot buttons on the remote control. And in the end, got to the point of saying, oh, is the diagram on the back of the guide we gave you too confusing? Oh, hang on, I'll turn the guide over. Oh, wow, that's really good. Thank you. And when you start supporting them, pretty much every issue they're going to have is yours. You really don't ever want to ship something that breaks on Christmas Day. We've actually had support calls on Christmas Day. The guy was really good. He said he'd wait till Boxing Day for a reply. If you're the newest and most complex part of their environment, as we tend to be, then any issues they have, they will come to you first. So in our case, the product connects to the TV, the stereo, pay TV set-top box if they've got it. It may be connecting to their home network, it's using their ADSL or wireless to get out to the internet. And any problem with any other bit of their equipment suddenly implies that we might be the source of the problem, because we're the newest bit. So Freeview service launches in New Zealand and has a bunch of teething issues. No one bothers contacting Freeview, they all just try and contact me instead. What we actually started doing is if we realized Freeview was having a problem, we did an email to all customers warning them. Sky TV set-top boxes, periodic reboots and loss of signal. Go and talk to Sky, it's nothing to do with me. One of the classics were customers who had problems with scratched and damaged DVDs. Oh, this DVD doesn't play. Can you take it out and look at the surface? Oh, it's covered in crayon. Right, okay. You've got a four-year-old, haven't you? Yes. Might need to replace your DVD drive. But a typical one was actually silvers from selected Asian countries that weren't playing properly. And make sure you do understand their problems. Like, we make sure we run the same version of the product that they run, because I'm not going to watch normal TV. I use a PVR all the time. And what's great is we actually have my brother-in-law's family use one, and they're great stress testers because they've got kids and they really hammer the box. But they run the same version of the software, same hardware that everybody else has got. And once they build up trust in you, of course they're going to start recommending you. A lot of sales are through recommendations. Better late than never. That comes down to sorting out their problems. Make sure you do have a bug tracker and not just keeping odd emails and post-it notes. We had a customer report an issue, one of our very early customers, and I said, oh, it's going to be a while before we get to that. I'm waiting on a release from the Myth TV team. And about 6-9 months later, I got back to him and said, yeah, it's all resolved. The new patch is coming out. Just update your system. He was so pleased. He told all his mates he was pleased. I got some referrals. And we've built a lot of relationships in our business space. That helps us solve customer problems before the customers realize they're a problem, because we've got contacts within the industry and we know what's happening and what's about to come up. And it assists with ongoing product development. Terrestrial digital TV is going to launch in New Zealand in May. And through our relationships, we're able to hopefully meet that target and have our product ready for go live for digital terrestrial in May. Despite the fact we're a small fish and the big companies are used to dealing with large set-top box manufacturers. So in summary, if you're going out there, make sure your information's clear. Make sure it is really consumer-friendly, not geek-friendly. We found it's well worth being completely honest in terms of what your product's capable of. It saves a lot of complaints and issues and very, very odd questions. And be adaptable. One of the biggest potential markets for our product now has nothing to do with selling to consumers, it's selling to businesses. There's basically the capabilities of the product in an entirely different market space. and we can hopefully adapt to this, means that we can keep supporting our existing customers, but go off in new and interesting directions. And do remember, everyone loves eye candy, especially if you're going out through retail. They like to put something on that's going to catch the eyes of the customers when they come through that shop door. Yeah, don't underestimate your support. We did. I just spent a hideous amount of time trying to improve documentation and provide additional online documentation. And especially when we first sold to a new customer, it was amazing what they'd expected from the product that we'd never taken into account, that we had to help them through. And anyone who actually read the notes coming along to the talk would have seen the true meaning of BYAG. So what was this all about? You think the way you do about your product because you're a geek. So if you have been developing a product, if you've been working on it, if you're really getting off on it, you're geeking out about it. And at that point, you're not actually thinking the way your potential customers are thinking. You're a geek, and you're not your actual target market anymore, unless you're targeting geeks, of course. So big thank you to LCA for having us, our customers for a very interesting education, and everyone in the community who've been a really big help in terms of developing the product, and especially Freeview New Zealand, who are recognising that the community is there and helping out to make sure that we're well supported. That's where we got all the various images from, though sadly the IT crowd images can't go into the webcast because of copyright reasons. So any questions from the audience? Was everyone just in shock?
When you first started out, how many test units did you develop for the initial sort of prototyping?
Okay, the question was how many initial test units did we develop? The gestation of the product was crazily long. I've been trying to build a PVR for like 5 years, so it was very carefully judged in terms of what hardware we were using. I wanted really good high-definition video playback, good TV out, had to support analog TV because I still actually run with an analog TV, had to potentially support at least DVI to HDMI, VGA, SPDIF, doing digital audio, wanted all the good bits in there. And it finally, 2 years ago, the right motherboard was available. So we built a prototype around that and began to realize that it was shockingly more rock solid than most of the people on the mailing lists and the groups in terms of hardware quality and what it was capable of. So we built a couple more units and they became our demo units. And so we didn't actually have a lot, hold a lot of hardware. It was just a kind of dipping our toe into the market, trying to see how well it would work. And initially we did it all direct. We didn't go through retail. We kind of put the web front out there and said, hey, come to us, come and buy this. And we did some Google AdWords and then did a trade show with a revision of the product, basically because of using PC technology, motherboards have got a finite life cycle. And luckily, when we switched motherboards, we had to change one line of code. Actually, one line in a config file to support the new motherboard with the same build, because we were careful about the hardware choice. One of the worst mistakes people make when they start playing with things like Myth TV is they go and use a four-year-old motherboard and this piece of kit from over there and the cheapest tuner card they can find, and they don't judge what they're using. One of the biggest things we did was everything was carefully judged in terms of the hardware. It made a huge difference, made sure it was rock solid. Yeah, we can upgrade our existing customers to the new motherboard. They may need to for digital terrestrial because New Zealand's going for an interesting form of H.264, and the processing power required to decode it, they may need to jump to dual core in the existing motherboard, whereas it was a socket 939, it's really hard to get the chips. What's made it hard for us now is that version 2 of the product's been out so long that that motherboard's now being replaced. So we're actually working on a version 3 code base to support things in the future. So yeah, it's possible, Most customers, all they've ever needed to do is add additional tuner cards, and they come to us. We'd rather they came to us and we gave them certified cards. Like before we even send out a tuner card, it's in a test rig, it's run for 24 hours to make sure it works. And we've had people say, well, why are you like 20 bucks more than the guy on Trade Me or eBay? Well, because we've actually tested the card before it goes to you, because I don't want the support call.
How do you guys manage software updates?
How do we manage software updates? The original build was based off NotMyth, if anyone knows that particular distro. And very early on, we started having our own support repository. So we do our own builds of Myth TV. NotMyth is Debian based, so basically it's apt-get update, apt-get upgrade. We actually have adapted the Myth interface, so there's a My PVR support menu, and the top one is check for updates, and the next one is apply updates. And we send out all customer emails saying these important patches are out, or there's been new channels loaded, or there's new channel icons available, and then you just got click, everything just happens. And that's it, stress tested for quite a while before it goes anywhere near a customer. Do we have any issues with noise and power? We made clear early on that the hardware is fairly kick-ass, so we weren't going for uber small form factor and restricted use of what devices you can stick into it. One, something that was quite expandable. But we did do very careful selection, made sure that all the cool and quiet support was working really well. The cases we use have very low noise fans. The system dynamically underclocks, and in fact, under typical use at the moment with standard dev TV, it never goes above its minimal clock speed. And the units are running with energy efficient AMD processors, so that the processor cores you're running between 27 and 32 degrees Celsius, so it never needs to actually pump any of the fans up. A few people have talked about trying to run them fanless. We had one customer ask if his special heat sink would fit in the case. The heat sink was twice the height of the case. He did consider cutting a hole in a few things and then asked if I would support him if he did that. No, sorry, no. Well, we didn't have any kind of budget for anything like that. The original case was chosen because that was the case I wanted. Yeah. And then everyone really liked it. So that was cool. When we went to do a trade show with version 2 of the product, we actually brought in a range of cases from a manufacturer at the trade show. We just had them empty on the stand. We had a few test units made up. We had them empty on the stand, and everybody who turned up went, yeah, great, love the cases. So that worked well, and the cases were well reviewed in the market. But no, we didn't actually do any. We did have some feedback from people who come up and say, "Oh, we really like your product at the price, but with this case that actually costs $1,200 for a case or something." You know, really uber sexy cases. We're going, no, because our cases are costing us like $300, so we'd have to put an extra $900 on the price.
Issues with user interface.
If you come along to the open day, we've brought a unit over with us. One of the interesting pieces of feedback was, oh, the GUI's too like Media Center, or the GUI's not close enough to Media Center. Couldn't win either way, really. We tended to ship the default skin on Myth as the Media Center look style. We now have a bunch of additional skins that are a lot sexier and actually more iPod-ish for some reason. In general, in retrospect, I should have disabled more of the user interface and hidden more of the features. We made clear early on all the capabilities of Myth, and a lot of them people never use. We could have hidden the games, we could have disabled some of the other net style features, and weather breaks all the time, so we really should have just said, no, we'll not ship with Myth weather. But in general, people found it easy to use. Very, very early customers, we did, we included delivery and on-site training. Came in, installed it, made sure it all worked, because they were our early adopters and testers, and did a quick run-through. One of the best examples of though the user interface was something we actually did for a disabled customer. We've got a customer in Christchurch who's got cerebral palsy. He contacted us, and it was very, very long time into the discussion about the product that we actually realized he was disabled, because he was talking about how he's going to access the unit. So what we cooked up for him was a web-based remote control that's GPL, it's available. We really should try and get it included with the standard Myth ship from the Myth team. Basically, he has a special computer and a special keyboard and mouse that he uses to control his environment, and he can actually speak. So it's got a text-to-speech interface and everything. So he fires up his web browser, and there's a series of buttons, and he can do all the features that a normal person can do, fully able-bodied person, I should say, can do with a remote control through the web interface. But we actually cooked the interface up in conjunction with this customer. We got a local guy to go in and install the unit in Christchurch. The feedback we got was quite incredible. He says he barely finished powering it on, and this guy had remoted in through the web interface and was already programming all of his favorite shows. He's one of our best customers in some ways because he provides really good feedback. He's very technical. He really gets it. He loves the box, and his father thinks we're the best thing since sliced bread because his son is having a whale of a time with the box. We've not really made any money at that sale at the end of the day because of the time and effort involved, but man, it was so cool.
So, is it successful
that you're selling? Sadly, we're not selling shitloads because of this tipping point. We started the project 2 years ago. Well, we kind of launched the product 2 years ago. We did a trade show 18 months ago that had the most amazing feedback. And that was just prior to the digital satellite launch in New Zealand. So we thought, great, you know, we're on the cusp of digital, because at the end of the day, Myth works at its best with a digital signal versus analog. And then everything got delayed and delayed. And then terrestrial got put back even further. And so the adoption has been quite slow. And also expectations of what the customers were really after. Weren't really aligning with how we were originally targeting the product. In New Zealand, a lot of people have got pay TV, so they want something to control their Sky set-top box, do their analog, and then when they start seeing, if anyone's ever tried to record off a pay TV set-top box onto a PVR, there's a reasonable degradation in video quality, so it wasn't quite what they expected. They were actually expecting better video through the PVR than off the set-top box direct. I'd never considered that. I knew it was going to look worse. I'd never warned them about it. So we haven't sold a lot, which is a real shame.
On the business side of the company, as far as sales is concerned, God made pretty clear to us at one point that in a product like this, you've really got two choices. You can either put on a very expensive suit and go knocking on some very expensive doors, all the gold cabling and all the beauty flash with huge prices on it, and sell maybe a dozen euro to make money. Or you go to China, you find someone who's going to knock them out at $50 a pop and go to the Harvey Norman's of the warehouse and stuff like that. And that's a really big thing for a two-person team to try to
figure
out where we put in between when the choice is really up here as to what.
And we found very early on we had to go retail. The moment we went retail and put a retail margin on, it was hard to be competitive. We're still actually cheaper at $2,000 New Zealand than some of the Windows-based PVR solutions in New Zealand, and we've got better capability. But we're not in the kind of typical consumer price bracket because of that. But we go out through high-end hi-fi shops, the kind of guys who will actually spend more on their cables than they will on our product, you know. But as Cherise said, we actually had some advice, and someone said, yes, you need to have this manufactured for sub-$100 New Zealand and sell at around $500 New Zealand. If any of you were in the session here on Asterix earlier, and he's talking about price markups, We also find it hard to go retail. We talked to a few companies who wanted to buy it from us and then triple or quadruple the price they were on selling at. So we said, oh, well, this is our RRP. So they divided that by four and said they wanted to buy it at $500. There's over $1,000 worth of hardware in the box. By the time you include the case, the high-end motherboard, the choices we made, and they wanted to buy it for $500. And us to chip in for their advertising costs.
Oh, you know, very well. We had two
groups of we don't supply phone support. The question was how do we deal with phone support? That's the thing. It's not cost effective for us. There's no way we could do it. We made that clear early on. Our supports, email and web, occasionally we will phone a customer that's got themselves right tangled up. And there are some of our very first customers have my phone number because they were early adopters. And some of them still do phone me up about the most bizarre things. So we kind of stopped doing that very early on. Do we have terminology issues? Hell yeah. A favorite one is what should I say this one or not? An awful lot of people think that their computer is the screen and that the box next to it is a hard drive. Right? That's a real simple one. We have a lot of problems with terminology. So usually there's three or four emails backwards and forwards before we have a clear idea of what the customer is talking about.
Are you planning on offering digital software or updates to rival, say, Linux MCE or any other?
Are we looking at providing additional layers and things to make it equivalent to MCE? A lot of those things were considered early on. At the moment, we're not too sure where we're going to go with the product right now because we're not getting the sales to fund the R&D that we want to do. But it doesn't prevent me from doing myth-based R&D because I'll be doing that anyway in some form. I play with Linux MCE, or at least I tried to. According to the specs, our hardware should just support it really nice and cleanly, and it just would not install.
Yeah, just quickly checking, I apologize. Myth, I'm assuming that's the actual open source operating system on the screen.
Myth TV is a open source equivalent to MCE in some ways. It's been described as TiVo on steroids. So it runs on top of Linux and provides all of your PVR functionality.
Right. So what actual distro is actually
used? Well, we used initially NotMyth, which is a Debian derivative with all of the Myth TV bits kind of designed to work very quickly. So it gave us a quick bring up time early on. That's mutated quite a lot since then. There's additional device drivers we've added on the side. We ship our own build of Myth with backports from trunk into the stable branch so that our consumers have got all the features they expect. And one of the things we did is that the digital TV standard in New Zealand has a particular interactive TV standard that's supported for the UK but wasn't supported for the New Zealand variant of it. They'd made a few modifications to the standard for the local market. We worked with the guys in the UK, got the Myth code updated and tested. So anyone in New Zealand can use this, all went back into the community. But that went into Myth TV's main branch, development branch, but we backported it into the version we shipped to all of our customers. So the day Freeview launched, you could buy two official set-top boxes with the ability to look at this interactive TV stack or our product. That was it in the whole market. And it's still that case today. There's probably nothing on Windows that can support this stack. Linux MCE is like an additional layer. excuse me. It's built on top of Pluto at Home. Pluto at Home still exists.
I was just trying to build a myth box unsuccessfully due to graphics cards not talking to an analog TV properly. Do you know of any similar products on the Stratocaster?
Now, there's an outfit here called D1, who for a long time hid the fact that they were based on Myth TV. They reskinned it, and if you look deep enough into their website, there was some vague reference to the GPL. We've actually been talking to customers, companies in Australia about potentially licensing the brand effectively we've built up, because we've had reasonably good brand awareness now. We've actually been interviewed and reviewed in Linux Journal. We've been reviewed in the press in New Zealand, and we've been building up industry relationships. So here's a chance to actually leverage your brand.
Sorry, follow-up question. Would you, once you've got the digital side of things worked out in New Zealand, would you consider marketing a product in Australia, also digital, for whatever we've got here?
Well, that's where we'd look at getting some local partners, because there's some major differences in terms of what Australia's done with digital TV versus New Zealand. So we'd need some local help in terms of getting any kinks out, but notionally the build and the hardware and everything else would just work here. Legally, luckily in New Zealand, there's a number of patents that do not apply, so we don't have to actually license certain technologies in order to ship. For example, MP3, there are no, most of the MP3 patent stack hasn't been applied for in New Zealand, which is kind of nice. Saves us lots of money. Sadly, though, there's about to be a law change in New Zealand that may actually make our product illegal, because the changes to this bill called the Copyright Amendment Bill require the manufacturer to put in place certain practices and safeguards, most interesting of which was that you cannot format shift TV if it is made available on demand. How you're supposed to know it's made available on demand isn't covered, but the impetus is on the hardware manufacturer to implement a system such that you cannot record a program if it is made available on demand. We're testing a multi-rec build on what would be a, if we ever ship it, a version 3 of the product. The issues we've got is, I've said, the way that they're going with digital TV terrestrially in New Zealand potentially means a major hardware shift, hardware upgrade, and that's the point where we'd go out with things like multi-rec. It's unlikely we'd put multi-rec out to most of our existing customers at the moment. You just got to see how those things come through. Myth UI is going to be in 22, maybe, 23. Okay. Last I heard, it wasn't going to be in 21 because he wanted to get 21 out.
Okay, we've got time for one last question. So, you said the module was really important. Is there a particular type of module that's not important for you?
Yeah, though it's not being made by Asus anymore. We were using the M2N PVVM, which is really nice because it's one of the few motherboards out there that has composites, S-Video, components, VGA, and DVI all on one motherboard. And when you're dealing with this market, it's surprising the number of people we've got that don't have a digital connection on their large screen TVs. We can actually do upscaling to HD over component, which is a big deal.